Hello, everyone. It is Thursday, January 19th. We are the Godfathers of Podcasting. Let's go.
You are now about to witness the strength of street knowledge.
Welcome back to the 122nd installment of the Godfathers of Podcasting. In case y'all didn't know, we have been podcasting since before podcasting was even called podcasting. And as always, archives of this program are available on every major podcast provider. Anywhere you get music, you get this show. Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Google, iHeartRadio, you know the drill. Video archives, however, are only available on our website, godfathersofpodcasting.com. We are live right now. It is 8.02 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you can text us. You can get us on WhatsApp. The number is up on the screen. It's 437-375-2000. Send us your feedback. Send us your questions. Send us questions for tonight's guest. Whatever you got, make it good. And we will run it on the air. My name is Donnie Da Silva, and it is my distinct pleasure to introduce the Simon to my Garfunkel, the Sonny to my Cher, the Ernie to my Bert. Ladies and gentlemen, this is my man, Notorious T.I.D., Chris Tidwell.
What is going on, Jafakin Bacon Boy? That's you.
What are you doing, buddy?
Nothing. What are you doing? I'm trying to win some stuff on an auction right now. So,
Okay. Sorry to distract you from doing a live broadcast.
Well, hey, what can I say? I'm trying to multitask here, you know?
We're trying to do a live show, and this guy's worried about an eBay gimmick.
No, it's not even an eBay gimmick. It's some other stuff.
What are you trying to win? What are you trying to buy?
I don't know.
What are you wasting your money on? What horror memorabilia are you trying to acquire?
No, I'm actually trying to pick up a new camera and actually an attachment, a mop head attachment for my Dyson.
Oh, a mop head attachment for your vacuum?
That's what I fucking said. Yeah.
This feels
it's like a dual mop head. No, you can look them up. Dyson actually, go to Dyson. They have these things. You can look them up. And there's these attachments that go on the end of your Dyson. And I figure, well, the fucking things cost so goddamn much. You might as well get as many attachments as you can for it.
Because, see, I have an opposite school of thought. For what it costs, it should already do everything.
Yeah, it should. Seriously. It should
clean the house and finish you off before bed.
Oh, it does that. It's a Dyson.
Of course it does.
That's why I got to get the mop attachment.
What did he say?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for hanging out with us tonight. If you want to send us a message, it's 437-375-2000. You can ask us questions. You can suggest something that you want us to talk about. Or you can send in questions for tonight's guest, who we're super excited to have join us in a little while. Tid. We should mention off the hop, the two of us, although it's not the subject matter normally.
Just the two of us?
I mean, if you want to be intimate.
We can make it if we try.
The two of us for a long, long time have been involved in the pro wrestling world, and the pro wrestling world is in mourning this week with the news that a couple nights ago, Jay Briscoe died in a car accident at the age of 38. I don't know, Tid, if you had any dealings with Jay Briscoe. My interactions with him begin and end with trying to book him for indie wrestling shows up here, and him always being busy or not being vaccinated, not being able to get into Canada, or other, like he and his brother, they were just always booked, right? Of course. Getting them to come up here is a bit of a nightmare, but we did try and look into that. I'd had no other personal interaction with him. What about you?
Sure. I've met him maybe less than a handful of times. Every single time that I've ever, it's always been completely fine. He's a hell of a human being. He's a hell of a talent. Him and his brother were a hell of a tag team together. It's an absolute shame that this happened. 38. I mean, any age less than 100 is sad to see it happen. But I mean, and the circumstances of, like, he was taking his kids to do family stuff, and it's just out of nowhere. I mean, it's tragic. And let's just hope that, you know, the rest of the family can do everything in his name and move on, you know, eventually. It's going to be tough.
You know, what's crazy is professional wrestlers put a lot of miles on the road.
Yeah.
Right. A lot of miles driving from town to town, making their shots. You don't hear often about pro wrestlers dying in car accidents on their way to a show, but there have been prominent pro wrestlers died in car accidents on their off time. I think of Randy Macho Man Savage,
of course,
who had cardiac arrest down in Treasure Island, Florida, mm-hmm. and smashed into a tree. I think of Sylvester Ritter, the Junkyard Dog, who fell asleep at the wheel. You know, I think he was dealing with sleep apnea or something like that and literally fell asleep at the wheel. There's been some like that. I mean, obviously, then there's also like the Joey Morella, Adrian Adonis story from out in Newfoundland,
right?
Which was horrible. But with the amount of miles that the Briscoes put on the road, you would think if there was going to be a horrible tragedy like this, it would have happened while putting a million miles on the road, not probably, I don't know where he was, but close to home.
Yeah.
Absolute tragedy. And my understanding, I don't have much news on this, but my understanding is his daughter, who's in the cars, is in hospital. She's having
both of them,
both
two daughters, oh two daughters. God. One of them is having surgery on her back.
Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. That is really sad. Our thoughts go out to that entire family. They are going through hell right now. A lot of pro wrestling fans are getting pissed off at, like, you know, one of the big companies out there saying, oh, you should have aired a tribute show. And like, who cares? Like, you know, to me, that's not what this is about right now. You know,
AEW did something. They did a tribute show that's going to air. With it. They did a Ring of Honor thing because Tony owns it all.
Right.
And he flew everybody in, like he flew them all in last minute to put this thing together.
Right.
So, I mean, that makes sense. It's Ring of Honor. That was the big thing. But I mean, outside of that, there's don't be mad at the WWE. They acknowledged it. NXT acknowledged it right away. Yeah. Like when
for guys that never worked there.
Exactly. So like, to all of you that are just, you know, wanting to spew shit on the fucking internet, just go do it someplace else, man.
People just get offended by everything. Our thoughts are with the family. Absolute tragedy. And everyone I know in the business that knew Jay Briscoe talks about what a stand-up guy he was. Obviously not a perfect human. He had his own controversies in life. But, you know, everyone that knew him personally talked about what a great guy he was.
Absolutely.
Last week, Tid, moments after we ended our show, there was news that broke that Lisa Marie Presley had just passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we didn't get a chance to talk about that last week because it literally just happened. Her funeral will be this Sunday at Graceland. She is, of course, the sole heir to the Elvis Presley estate, the Elvis Presley, I was going to say fortune, the Elvis Presley debt.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently, well,
she amassed a lot of debt when she took over his estate, and died with a net negative, worth. Again, never met Lisa Marie Presley, have no personal interaction with her whatsoever, but I know people that have, and they all say that she was just one of the finest human beings ever. So it's another tragedy. She was so young, like in her early 50s, right?
So many people dying way too early. Welcome to 2023. But moving on.
Someone who's apparently not dead, that we thought was dead. Remember when the pandemic first started back in 2020? And everyone was obsessed with Tiger King. It's like the pandemic started. We were all locked at home and Tiger King debuted on Netflix. It's like it was aligned perfectly. So everyone's binging it because, hey, there's new content on Netflix. And what the hell is this circus sideshow? And one of the principals on that program, that documentary, Carol Baskins, Carol fucking Baskins. There were a lot of allegations made on that show that Carol Baskins had killed her former husband, Don Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
The Tiger King actually suggested that Carol Baskins had fed Don Lewis to one of her lions, her tigers.
Sure.
Carol Baskins apparently last year or 2021 did an interview where she said, no, Don Lewis is living alive and well, and he's in Costa Rica. Don Lewis has not been seen in person since 1997. And in 2002 was legally considered deceased.
So this motherfucker's like Tupac.
That's the thing, man. Like all over the internet this week, there's stories. Carol Baskin's husband is alive. And that story has gone viral everywhere.
Get him on camera.
But no one's seen him.
Exactly.
He's not coming out going, hi, everybody. there's no word from this guy.
This is well, you know what it is. They're probably trying to trick her.
You think it's a setup?
Yeah, it's a setup for her to finally be like, listen, I know he ain't alive in Costa Rica. I killed him.
That's like the third act of a really bad whodunit from the 1960s.
It's like that's
he
one of those
can't
murder,
be in Costa Rica.
Murder mystery.
I killed him.
Murder what? Mystery oh, no. Dinner theaters, and all of a sudden it's like, listen, all right, I got to be someplace in like 20 minutes. I killed him. Got to go.
We got a text message that came in. Actually, it's on WhatsApp from area code 709. Where the hell is 709?
I don't know.
East Coast, maybe. It says, "Hey Tid, I read the retrospect on your career that was posted this week on Slam Wrestling. You've obviously had a really interesting life. I was surprised to read you're retiring because of a spine injury, because I never heard you talk about that on this show. How bad is it? Will you be stuck in a wheelchair?"
I mean,
I don't know how much you want to talk about this, so it's up to you.
Will I eventually be stuck in a wheelchair? I don't know. No. I mean, probably, but it won't be from my spine. Probably from my liver. it's not something that I really ever talked about because I didn't ever really think that it was a thing until I was diagnosed with it, because I just looked at it as everyday pain due to what I do. That's mm-hmm. it. Yeah. So yeah.
You put I'll be eating fine. On your body for 26 years.
Yeah. So. And I'm not the daintiest of human beings to begin with. So that's a lot of like mass falling on your spine. Right. So,
but your day-to-day living condition right now is okay.
Fucking great.
I mean, I know I'm just telling so the people stop fucking texting and poor Tid.
No. Until you see the GoFundMe go up, don't worry about it. I'm good.
We got another message that came in. This one was sent in earlier today from area code 917. It says, "Hey guys,
917.
What did you think of Power Slap? It debuted on TBS this week. Will this be a place for popular retired fighters to extend their time in the spotlight? Thanks. Love the show."
No. No, it will not. It will not be a place for that because most of those tired, over-the-hill, washed-up fighters are not giving up fighting professionally until their chins can't take it anymore. And yeah, I did watch this Power Slap thing. I took a couple of things away from it. They're obviously going to fit this into the formula like they did with the Ultimate Fighter show, where they put them all into a house and let the drama ensue. A couple of things made me laugh out loud, other than just the sheer audacity of this program and this quote unquote sport, as it were. First of all, these guys that were coming in screaming like they're a badass, "I'm here to kick ass and take names and slap people." You're telling me you're the toughest slapper in the world? Okay, that's cool. And then you're also going to tell me that you've been dreaming about this your entire life. Bro, this is a thing that just started like 7 minutes ago in Russia. And you're going to tell me that you've been dreaming about this and you're going to change the world by slapping. Now, The guy that I did like, I can't remember his name, because everybody was talking about like the rules and what you got to do. And everybody was like giving out like, okay, I'm going to go right hand on three. Right. So they get a couple of whatevers. My favorite dude last night, he was like right hand on one and just bitch slap a motherfucker like down on his fat ass. I was like,
sent him to another postal code.
That's proper. None of this line it up. Just like, shut your mouth and sit down. So I think I've probably seen all that I need to see of this.
Yeah.
You know, because.
Oh, you're not going to stick around with it.
Listen, even with the Ultimate Fighter, house drama doesn't really, none of those house drama shows do anything for me. That's probably more up your alley. You know what I mean? Because you're a.
Oh, because it's a reality show.
Yeah.
But you didn't like The Ultimate Fighter when that first started out?
When it first started out, yeah. But you watched it. Yeah, absolutely did. But it lost its luster with me, you know, very quickly. And it's clearly the same exact formula this time around with this slap league thing, right?
And I think it's a smart formula. They want to have a reality TV show so that they are selling personalities.
Yeah.
Because they know that's the secret to getting people engaged.
Absolutely.
I think that's smart. I think that's really smart.
Well, you weren't going to be able to go any other way with it.
No, if they were just going to market a show based on men and women smacking each other in the face, that's going to be a tough sell.
Right.
I do think that a lot of that, you know, a lot of that stuff, like, okay, ready? On what's your count? I'm going to hit him on three. I'm going to measure. I think they're overemphasizing a lot of that. Number one, to teach the sport because it's brand new. Number two, they want to reinforce to the audience this is sanctioned by an athletic commission, and it's not just a bunch of barbarians that are going at it. They're trying to show the over the overabundance of rules, right?
If you win the coin toss, you go first. Yeah. Chances are you've got an automatic 75%+ chance of winning because you're going to get to knock this mofo out first.
Yeah.
It's not a sport because there's no defense to it.
It's like overtime in the NFL, Ted.
It actually, when they put that bar behind their back and make them hold on to that, it actually pulls your shoulders back and pushes your head out further, making you even more susceptible to getting your head blocked off, right?
Yeah,
like it's funny. Holy fuck, I was in stitches laughing. You know what I mean? Because who doesn't like to see a motherfucker get slapped upside the head?
I know. You texted me like, please tell me you're watching this.
Oh my god!
Another text message that came in on our WhatsApp hotline from area code 319. This one says, guys, Audio Technica recently announced the return of the portable vinyl turntable. If you haven't seen it, it looks like a little box with a turntable arm, and you just put your vinyl right inside of it. I'm trying to understand who the market is for this gadget. Real vinyl heads want a true turntable. And do the newbies to the genre care enough to actually go out and spend money on this hobby? Thanks.
It's going to be people that are my age, because that was the name brand of the record player that they had when they were kids. So they're going to want that just so that it can sit in their bar that they don't do anything with. It just, it's there for a, you know, a conversation piece, so to speak. Nobody's going to be using this thing if they're a true like vinyl head. If not, then it's just going to be a flashback thing. And if you're complaining, how much are these things? Does it say?
That's a good question. I don't know. It doesn't say in the text. Let me see if I can find it.
You know what I mean? Because if somebody's going to take the time to put these things out, they're clearly putting them out to a market that remembers them, because it's a retro thing, right? So if that's the case, you're talking about people that actually got some income to spend on their childhood stuff. So I'm guessing these things are going to be a couple $100 at least, right? Whereas it probably cost the kid like 20 when he was a kid, right?
Yeah, I'm not seeing a unit price. If anyone knows the answer to that, how much these Audio Technica portable vinyl gimmicks are going to cost, let us know.
Do you have any vinyl?
I do not anymore. I don't have any. This is going to sound bad because I love music and I'm a bit of an audiophile. I love good audio.
I don't really have any physical music anymore, you know, because like I've moved so many times in the last few years. I got sick of moving shit around. Some of it I still have in storage. Some of it I sold off. Some of it I got rid of. I used to have a few milk crates of vinyl. I had a shit ton of CDs. Some of those I don't even know where they are anymore. And now I just have everything sitting right here. You know, right. It's all there now. Is the audio quality as good on Spotify as it is when you listen to, you know, an analog recording? No, of course it's not.
What am I listening compressed. For? You know what I mean? Am I listening because I want to hear the nuances, or am I listening because I like the song?
Right. If you're not a you true audiophile, you don't give a shit. It's good enough.
Exactly.
And for the majority of the listening public, it's good enough. Like people have spoken, right? The record shops have gone the way of the dinosaur. They're just not around anymore.
It's crazy.
You can find them, but they're few and far between. It's not like when I was a kid and the record shop was the coolest place in the mall.
But apparently they're making a comeback, and they must be making a comeback if companies like this are coming back with record players to
maybe,
you know.
They've been saying this for years, that vinyl's making a comeback, and like it does these little teases. It like tickles you underneath a little bit, and then it just
maybe we just don't live in that life.
It's just also hard to explain to the casual music listener. You're going to buy this player that's going to cost you $300-$400, and then each album of one artist's music is going to cost you about $30-$40.
Mm-hmm.
Or they could pay $10 a month and have unlimited resources to the galaxy of music.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough sell. You right. really got to love that delivery method of correct. Sound.
Yeah.
There's another text message that came in from 289. That sounds like it's close by. Hey guys, what are your thoughts on David Crosby passing away today? Tid, did you know? Are we breaking news?
Did I know David Crosby? No.
Did you know he passed away?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And
I only found that out right before we went on the air.
Yeah. Again, you know, hopefully he's got some family members that are going to be able to cope with all of this. But I mean, David Crosby, what was he, in his 80s? Got to be in his 80s.
I would think.
You know what I mean? Like, are we shocked? No. I mean, I kind of thought that he was already dead.
Oh, stop. But
if I'm being honest. No, if I'm being honest. Like,
he was 81.
Yeah.
Says here he suffered from a long illness. Let's see. He died last night. Yeah, he was dealing with all kinds of heart problems since like 8 years ago. So
crazy.
Yeah. The guy's had a rough run for the last little while. Maybe
we're all apples. Days. We're all apples, people. And some of us just rot away faster than others.
Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. One of the great protest bands, right?
Yes.
When you talk about that protest sound of music, they're absolutely. Up there. One of the greats of all time.
Yep, you betcha.
Tid, before we get to our guest, there's another text message that just came in at 437-375-2000. This one is from area code 617.
All right.
Guys, what are your thoughts on the Elon Musk trial? This guy went from being tech Jesus to a societal virus. In case you're out there and you don't know much about the Elon Musk trial that begins next week, back in 2018, before he owned Twitter and he was just the Tesla guy,
right,
Elon Musk had tweeted out saying that he had secured funding to buy out Tesla for $72 million. And apparently that money was coming from the Saudi Arabia Investment Fund. This got a lot of people really excited and caused stocks to go bananas on Tesla. He then sent another tweet that made it sound like this sale, this takeover was imminent. Like it's about to happen, folks. The buyout never happened. That never went down. The funding fell through with Saudi Arabia. And now there are stockholders who claim to have lost billions as a result
of this information that Elon Musk had put out. Billions.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know what is going to come of this. I don't even what is this? Is this like reverse insider trading? I don't know what it is at this point,
but the funny thing is like, he's one of these guys that's got the funds where it doesn't even seem to affect his day to day. You know,
he set the Guinness Book of Records record for losing the most money in a single year.
I think that guy qualifies. I think that guy qualifies as a dirtbag.
Ah, that's a he's a middle-aged dirtbag.
Middle-aged dirtbag.
Is that how you transition to it?
That's what you call a segue in the business there, Don.
You are so slick. Ladies and gentlemen, it is time right now for us to do the big hello. And as part of this intro, we're going to have the audience play a little game with us. And you know what? Our guest, he can play along too. Text us and let us know how many of this man's songs I reference in this intro. We'll send the winner a prize at the end of the program. This man originally hails from Northport, New York, where from the age of like 2, he seemed to be musically inclined and was often spotted singing along to Bobby Darin hits because he was looking for a little respect. Anyway, you punk ass bitch, he founded his band Wheatus way back in 1995. That's true. Since that time, he's released a handful of studio albums, a couple of lives, a bunch of EPs, a ton of singles, and a super smash hit. My pal Randall and Leroy, who's a bit of a fair weather friend, tell me that his timeless classic, Teenage Dirtbag, is the quintessential anthem to adolescent love and self-worth. It's less about hump 'em and dump 'em, and it's more about acceptance and personal exploration. It was released more than 22 years ago, yet every single kid on TikTok under the age of 14 knows it by heart. He's referred to his own music video, Wannabe Gangster, as the worst video ever, which makes me wonder if he's ever seen Susan Boyle or the Kings of Leon. I actually think the visuals for Wannabe Gangster would fit perfectly with the theme song to Greatest American Hero. But that's just me. He plays a wicked tambourine like he has the force from the dark side, and he can speak like a university professor on the intricacies of playing the shaker. And now, ladies and gentlemen, grab your lemonade, come gather around, give it up for BBB. This is Brendan B. Brown.
Wow. I hope you can hear me okay after that intro.
We hear you, sir.
Okay, absolutely. Good. Now that I have emeritus status for percussion, or I should say just shaker, I really don't know where to go from there. I feel like it's all downhill, you know?
The bar is very high.
The bar is way too high.
By the way, do you have a guess? You don't have to share it out loud until the end, but do you have a guess on how many of your song titles were in that intro?
I felt like maybe like it could have even gone double digits. I'm not sure. I was... You know, every time you said one, it's like a Rick and Morty cartoon. It's so traumatic that you miss the next 3 jokes, you know?
So what you're telling our live audience right now is to go back and check out the archive and re-listen a few times.
Yeah. You know, do your own research.
We're totally down with that. Hey, man, listen, thanks so much for hanging out with us tonight. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is fun. This is cool.
Yeah, man, it's wild. And I'm like a big fan. I've been a fan of Wheatus since album 1. I remember doing music radio back in the day, terrestrial radio, and playing Teenage Dirtbag what felt like 1,000 times.
Now, back then, did you have that weird upside down shaver that you have for a microphone? Because that looks like I could like do my beard with it, that thing. What is that? I've never seen that mic before. I've seen a lot of mics, but...
You've guaranteed seen this mic. It's the Yeti Blue.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's just mounted upside down.
Yeah. Yeah. You did something new with it. Yeah. Yeah. Right. The cool blue kids. Yeah.
I'm just hanging it from the ceiling. That's all.
Yeah. Okay.
So I did used to play your song. The station I was at was super broke. We had your song on carts.
Oh, wow.
physical media.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for putting up with, thank you for working under those circumstances.
And it's funny because I know that over the last, I don't know, year or two, you've done a ton of interviews and you've talked a lot about this process that you've gone through of re-recording that entire first album because of the masters having been lost. True. And I feel like I can relate, because when Tid and I started broadcasting together back in 1996 at the first ever online radio station, everything we did was recorded to DAT, which wow. means it's all gone.
So, yeah. So I have a DAT machine over in the other room because we have, for the first 3 years that we were on the road, we recorded every show onto DAT.
Wow.
And they've never been, you know, transferred. So we're going to, one of these days, one of the big, you know, the big transfer fantasy is to get this all in one place, you know, but we'll see if it actually happens. But the DAT machine thing, you know, you have to worry about whether or not they're going to work. You know, when
I
you kind
of want
play.
Them not to work, because I'm embarrassed of those old shows. Yeah. Like, I kind of like to take those DAT tapes and set them all on fire.
Are well, you, that's how I when I see our first album trending, sometimes I feel the same way.
Right.
I'm like, I get that. Oh, God, you know, there's stuff on there that like I wasn't finished cooking yet as a human and like all his feelings. But you know what? Then you go, OK, well, that's part of it, though. You know, like you were wrong.
Are you a bit of a machine hoarder? Like times, you know what I mean? Like, no, because you talk about a DAT machine. I guarantee somewhere in there you've got a couple of Tascam 4-tracks kicking around.
Yeah, I have one. I still have my first original Tascam Porta Studio 424. The lid for you can't close anymore, and you can't press stop. You have to press pause. But other than that, it still works. And I have all the demo tapes. I wouldn't say that I'm a hoarder. I'd say that I'm a maintainer of a few select items that nobody else cares about.
I love that. Yeah. I love that.
Spoken like a true hoarder.
Totally,
this is how he justifies it, and I'm respecting the justification.
Right. I was wondering if that was going to go over. I was like, oh, they haven't said anything. Oh, yep, he caught me.
Yeah, Tid doesn't let shit slide.
Yeah, my background kind of gives it away. This thing right here. That's from 1968, and like, you know, that's another one from 68. Like, these are from the 50s. These brown ones, and I shouldn't say that I hoard them. I have like a few items that are really important to me for sound, and I make sure that I maintain them at all costs. There's lots of good new stuff to buy, but I'm not really that excited about it. So that's yes, I do hoard old. Okay, fine.
When I feel like we have some audio engineering crossover because of when you started recording and the way that Tid and I started together, because we were in that weird sweet spot, Brendan, where the first ever theme song to our first show that he and I hosted together back in 1996, I cut the first version of that theme song on reel to reel with a razor blade and tape.
Wow.
And then
that's the real skill. If you can go back that far,
that was the shit, man. We had it on reel to reel, and I was cutting it with tape at my old post-secondary, at my old college. I had reel to reel. I'm sitting there with tape and I'm lining it up. And then I went to our studio, and one of our producers there taught me how to use this. It was like a precursor to Pro Tools, right?
Right.
Whatever the hell it was called.
Sonic Solutions, probably. Yeah.
Maybe. I don't. Or do you remember radar. What it was called, Tid?
No.
I don't care either.
He was so high. Like, there's so no chance.
Somebody needs to write a book about that period, because formats changed. So from the late 80s to when we made our record, formats changed so many times, and the standards changed so many times. It's basically the whole period, that whole 10 or maybe 12 years, is all transitional models of everything. Nothing stuck. Nobody uses that stuff anymore. It's all gone. DAT machines, ADATs, the machines that we use to record, a Tascam DA78HR, they were around for 3 years, and that was it. It was over. They were gone. Pro Tools came up. Our second album, we were full-blown Pro Tools, learned it, used it, forgot about the old machines. But that was only a year after our first record. So it was like everything was so quick. And of course, all those formats are going to be gone. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of other artists or shows or whatever else from that period, the original materials like deteriorated and missing because it was on a transitional format.
If you've got a song that you're working on that you'd like to have cut on Reel to Reel, I'm your guy, okay?
Yeah. You know, that's the cool part is Reel to Reel stuff is super cheap on eBay now. You can.
I'm disappointed I don't have my own Reel to Reel machine. I want one just to fuck with it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I used to, that was the first thing I ever learned how to use is my mother's Reel to Reel. She had Fleetwood Mac Rumors on it. And when I was like four, five or six, maybe, I used to actually know how to spool it up and find secondhand news. And that was like my big thing, like right after breakfast on a Saturday, I would like walk away from the cartoons and just like find secondhand news on the Reel to Reel and start playing it. That was like, just one of my earliest memories of like really using a machine, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. See, I was similar. Although at that age, I wasn't doing anything quite that advanced, but I remember my late father, he had taken this old stand-up radio from my grandmother's house. And it was one of those ones that comes in a giant cabinet and it worked all with vacuum tubes and shit.
Yeah.
And the cabinet was gorgeous, but it was all worn out. It was over 100 years old or whatever. So my dad had this goal. He was going to sand it down, refurbish it. And then we were going to work together to rebuild all those vacuum tubes one by one. And I was doing that at like age 9. And, you know, at the time I was like, what kind of voodoo is this? This little,
that's incredible. That's actually very advanced.
It was, you know, wild.
That's so weird you bring that up because that's what record companies were. They became furniture companies because they had to sell something that played their product, right?
That's right.
And you know, people weren't going to buy a gadget back in the 30s. They needed to buy something that did something else. So it had to be a bookshelf or a piece of furniture or like a table you could put your Thanksgiving treats on, you know? So all those original Victrolas and radios are all like a beautiful piece of furniture.
Yeah, they're all beautiful wood cabinets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't make any of that anymore. I can remember like we had one of the big long TV consoles, you know, you lifted up the entire thing. Oh, there was the record player, the 8-track player was in there as well.
Needed 8 guys to bring it into the living room.
Oh, yeah.
With a doily on top. It always had to have a doily. Exactly.
Yeah, right. With white lace curtain thing hanging off the edges of it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
When I think about that, and it's only apropos because Dolly Parton just celebrated her birthday.
Yeah.
But I think about that old cabinet stereo system that we had, and it had an 8-track and it had a turntable in there. And I remember when I was like, I don't know, 9, 10 years old, I'm going through the vinyl in there and looking at what my dad had in his collection. And I saw like 3 or 4 Dolly Parton albums. I'm like, Dad, you really like Dolly Parton's music? And he looks at me deadpan and goes, she makes music?
Dad.
See, we weren't even as kids, you weren't allowed to touch the records.
Well, you know what I mean? We did
ask for something to get put on because you're going to scratch it. You're going to scratch it.
Scratched every single one by the time I got to the 8th grade.
So my dad was kind of like, he wasn't an audiophile, but he would like buy the new stereo because he wanted to play like some Led Zeppelin or something. You know, he was into cassettes more than because it went in the car too, right? So I don't remember. I mean, my dad didn't have any vinyl. My mom and my grandmother had some vinyl, like about a shelf's worth, you know. And it was a lot of it was 78s and a few like the Drifters, White Christmas, and like some Beatles stuff. But you know, by the time we were like grown kids, CDs were there, tape cassettes were there. I had some vinyl myself that I'd bought. We had kind of replaced or destroyed their original like collection of music, but for the tapes, you know. So, we were not precious with the formats back then. We beat the hell out of them. You know?
You talk about like your parents being, you know, into the music they were into and whatnot, and obviously that was a different era than when you were a kid. Do you remember who the person was that like turned you on to that for like your, you know, Metallica, for example, Iron Maiden,
for example.
You know, well, what
Metallica's,
I mean?
Metallica's a great one because they didn't have radio play. So you had to know a cool person that introduced you to Metallica.
Well, hang on. I got 2 stories about that. So first was 1979. I was, what was I? Born in 73. So I was what? Do the math. 5 or 6, somewhere around there. 79, my cousin Dean, who was in his teens, I think he was probably 16 or 17. He came up for a summer to visit and he had Permanent Waves with him, the cassette.
Okay.
And he played me The Spirit of Radio for the first time when I was like six. And I was destroyed. I was like, what is this brilliant? So I remember thinking that it was more sparkly than it was possible to be. Like, it was just like alive and so brilliant. And that was my first dose of Rush. And it hit me hard. And I didn't really know how to catch up with Rush during, like, you know, when the Police were popular and like all that stuff. Right. Because Rush, if you remember in the 80s, Rush kind of went into a meandering like keyboard place. A lot of other bands like Dire Straits and Police and you know, Duran Duran and like Prince, they kind of like took over the bigger rock spaces. And it wasn't until 85 that I caught up with Rush when they released Power Windows, and The Big Money was a huge hit on MTV. So I'm already, it's mid 80s. I'm already an MTV person. I've heard of Metallica, but I'm probably not in any sort of proximity with them. And then I'm a few years later, 2 years later or 3 years later, 2 years later, I'm in high school and I get a copy of on cassette of all the songs they did on Garage Days. Last Caress, Green Hell, and Crash Course and Brain Surgery. And on the end of that is tacked on their cover of Bread Fan. And that was it. I was like, and the whole time I'm AC/DC, right? The whole time I'm like huge Angus Young. Angus Young is teaching me how to play guitar. I'm addicted to guitar. I want an SG for Christmas, the whole nine yards. Like I'm Angus for Halloween in 1985 and 86. Both.
Amazing.
Right, right. And then Metallica comes around high school. It was probably 88. It was probably the winter when Justice came out. And that changed everything because they were like this, like they were like Rush in that they were like super precise and like tech metal science-y kind of really tricky stuff to play. But when I went to see them at Nassau Coliseum when I was 14, they were the most irreverent punk rock experience. They were starting fights with each other on stage in front of 20,000 people. They were starting songs and then saying, no, fuck that. I don't want to play that right now. Let's start something else and then start another song. It was just chaos. And it was just so cool, man. It was, it blew my mind, their approach. And that was the year that they, when you say the kind of that we needed radio or TV, they, not a lot of people remember this, but Metallica had like a 9-minute version. The jamming version of One was on the top of the top 20 video countdown for like 17 weeks, like some insane thing. Right. And you couldn't get away from that song. And it was so cool. And, you know, there was nothing like it anywhere near the charts at the time.
Well, that was the times when you had like Michael Jackson making Thriller and you had these big, long production videos. Right. And then all of a sudden for a band like Metallica, you know, these greasy West Coast rocker dudes to put out this epic, just this massive long video, really just kind of like open the doors, I think, anyway.
Hell yeah. For dark as hell.
Yeah.
No happy ending, darker than it gets. Like and also it's like Justice is a super political album. Justice is like anti-Reagan, like, you know, fuck you, moral majority bullshit. Like it was intense. And I got a lot from that record, and still to this day, my favorite Metallica record is definitely Injustice for All. I know a lot of people have a lot to say about that record, but I feel like that's the one where, you know, Cliff had just died. Jason didn't have a chance to get up to speed. You know, James and Lars made an album for drum and bass, you know, or just drum and guitar rather. And the bass is all in the, like the low end frequencies on those guitar sounds are boosted so that there doesn't have to be any bass on the record. And it just, they did what they needed to do to make that album. And I think it's super special. Drum and guitar record exclusively. I don't mind that there's no bass on it. I don't think it was written that way. You know, like it's okay.
Well, I mean, if you think about where Jason, think about where Jason came from. Flotsam and Jetsam was not doing the type of stuff that Metallica was doing at the time. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, not even close to it. They were doing like Exodus type stuff still. They were doing Flotsam and Jetsam stuff.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden he's like, hey, we need a, you know, we need a bass player. We need to fill these spots. And it's like, but unfortunately you're going to have to learn on the fly.
Yeah. Well, it was like they were sailing into their greatest moment without their bass player. I mean, of course that would happen.
It's crazy.
I totally understand why. I mean, we could go off on this. There's a whole nother podcast. I totally understand why that record doesn't have bass. I don't blame anybody. It's nobody's fault. It's not less cool because of that. It was just circumstances. You're making a record inside of a year, that same year that your bass player had died. And then here comes Jason and he's thrown into the deep end. He doesn't have time to fit, doesn't have time to figure it out. He's just, you know, boom, this record's almost done. Like, what
and
is
in
the
fairness,
bass?
He wasn't just a bass player. He's like on almost everyone's list of one of the greatest bass players ever. Right?
You're talking about Cliff, like Cliff. Like replacing Cliff is like, that's not a thing. Like,
yeah, that's right.
How you know, can you do that? I mean, I think Trujillo kind of kills it, but that's at the time, it just didn't, that didn't
but
make
Trujillo
sense.
Trujillo is completely different too, because you think about like, you know, the Infectious Groove stuff. Some of this, I love Infectious Groove, not even the Suicidal Tendency stuff.
Yeah,
but
Suicidal,
like you know, the Infectious Groove, the more funky stuff that he does, and you listen to Trujillo slap, and it's like, okay, well, here's a guy like a Les Claypool bass player or something like that. You know what
right,
I mean? Like,
right.
Or even Geddy Lee, like they've got that kind of, you know, that kind of slappy kind of feel to them, and you're just going, okay. And then you hear Robert play his Metallica stuff, and you're like, now they've really come into their own. Kind of leads me to my question. How long, because we all know, I mean, anybody who knows you and your background and Wheatus and all of that, it's a process. It's a long process sometimes, right? To finally find your sound, so to speak, to find your groove, right? And sometimes there's a lot of bumpy roads. Are you still going down that road? Do you think you've found your sound and you just want to, you know what I mean, stay in that lane and stay in that?
No, I'll never find it. I mean, I still search for, sometimes we pull a song out of the vault that we used to play every tour we did from 2001 until 2015, right? We played this one song and we retired it for a little while. And I come back to it. It's like, I got to learn this whole thing over again. I don't have the voice of this anymore. Like this is an ongoing, it's like yoga or something. It's like, you know, if you don't play basketball every day, you're bad at it, you know?
Right.
Like that's just how it is. And it's like that with every song, because every song is this unique meandering journey of trying to make things fit and make sure everything's complementary and nothing's getting crisscrossed and, you know, offending each other, you know?
Is that causing problems with trying to re-record the first album at all?
There was a steep, steep, like, anxiety curve of forensic paranoia and weirdness that was like, you know, when you're making a new record, you're discovering the sound as you go. It's this like archaeology, like you feel like Indiana Jones, you're finding this like treasure, right? And it's an exciting process. The process is pushed along and adrenalized by the notion that you're gonna hit something, you know, that you're gonna hit like the diamond core of something, you know, and learn something new. When you're making an old record over again, there's none of that discovery. It's totally forensic. You're going back through old photographs and details and calling up your friends and saying, how the hell did we get this kick drum sound? What was this that we did? You know, because you don't want to make the record and just kind of like glance at getting it close, because you're disrespecting people who would appreciate that album if you do that. You know, don't re-record something if you can't at least shoot for the exact, you know, vibe that you hit.
Well, and I think for someone like you too, you'd have to resist that urge, that temptation to take those old songs and add a little bit of what you like now. I think of like someone who, you know, refurbishes old muscle cars. Like they have to resist the temptation to fuel inject that son of a bitch.
Yeah. Yeah.
They got to, resist the temptation to put a GPS in there.
Yeah.
Because they want it to be original.
Right. And the old classics all have something quirky and wrong with them that when they came out, people were like, well, this would be a great car if they just fixed this one thing about the blah, blah, you know. And the records are like that, exactly like that. So you're going in and you're going, shit, man, like, we really got that part of it wrong. We got to do that. We got to do that mistake again. Like, we you know,
right.
like, and and there were a few moments where it was like, let's try fixing it and see what happens. And it was about 80-20. It blew the song apart 80% of the time. 20% of the time, it was like, no, that's okay. That's going to fly. That'll be all right, you know? And people will either get what they already got out of it because it's so much honoring the original, but this one little tweak is not going to be something people get thrown by. So that was how we approached it. We made lists of mistakes, like for songs. It was so dumb. It was just like, you know, there's some of them are still tacked to the wall that I'm standing in front of, like this, right. Just ongoing, like forensic, like, you know, NCIS episode of making a record. And it was kind of boring at times, but then when we got it, it was like, wow, holy crap. I didn't think this would happen. Now we can move on, you know? Like, so it was like that.
This is our first time meeting, but I get this vibe, Brendan, that you might be a little bit of a perfectionist.
No.
Okay.
Perfect is not where I stop. I stop at like the hairs on the back of my neck go up. Right. I stop at like how I felt when I heard Rush the first time. If that emotion is triggered at all, broken or imperfect as something is. And if you listen to our records, you can hear like some of them are this loud, some of them are this loud, some of them are a little dark, some are bright, some are too bright. Like we go in all different directions, and there's no homogeny to the finishing process because I stop where I feel something. And you can call that like, that's where I feel perfect about it. I don't know, but it's definitely not perfect. It's totally imperfect. Any mastering engineer worth his salt would come in and say, what the hell are you doing? You know, this is nuts. Why'd you do it like this? And the answer is, I don't really know. It just made me feel that way. So that's how we operate. If you look at a song like the more recent tune that we released, I think 2016, is a song called Lullaby, right? Lullaby is a hot mess. The guy who mastered it for me, after I mixed it, we went back and forth like 10 times. He was like, I'm not really sure what you're doing here, you know? And finally he got it and it all snapped into focus. He's like, now I understand. This is like a totally weird jazz song. Like this is like a jazz song, a jazz standard classic, like Somewhere Over the Rainbow, but it's drowning in psychedelic metal tones that are like way out of hand. And that was just an experiment we wanted to try. And at first, for a little while there, it looked like it wasn't going to be succeed as a song. It was going to fall apart. And like, regardless of how many people like it or don't like it, if it just doesn't work, you're like, well, back to the drawing board with that. You know, you don't put it out, you know, but that one finally worked. And it's a process of like discovering something that you're doing that's new. You know, Teenage Dirtbag Hybrid took me 4 years to figure out, you know. James Taylor-y kind of Paul Simon acoustic with a sort of LL Cool J New York hip hop underpinning on the rhythm with like sort of Motown bass. But then when we get to the chorus, we go full on wall of Metallica meets Dinosaur Jr. And if I'd have come into a studio in the 90s with that kind of a description, whoever was working there would have told me to go away. You know,
they would have said, leave the drugs.
Yeah. So as opposed to being laughed out of every studio in New York, I took 4 years to figure out how to make that hybrid with this stuff you see behind you. And I only really kind of got there at the very last moment in March of 2000 at my mother's house, you know?
Right. So, I mean, you talk about the sound of Teenage Dirtbag and it's such an iconic song. But the thing that always trips me out, man, is the song still seems to resonate today. And that song was written in a time and speaks to a time where if you were that shy, nerdy kid in high school that had a crush on someone, you would just suffer in silence and hope that no one noticed that you had a crush, because if they found out, they would just ridicule you relentlessly.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So you just sat there in silence. And like today it's like, kids are real brave because they'll just Snapchat someone and be like, hey, what's up? And then if they,
I love that. I'm so glad that that's happening for young people these days. I definitely cannot relate. Right. Where I grew up, by the time your lip was shaking in public, you were about to get your head pounded in. So it was like,
right,
that never, like, it's all a fantasy. It never really happened. Teenage Dirtbag has this happy ending that is, you know, unreal. I was talking to a friend recently about that. It's like, maybe that's the thing. It's this like it's this chance to engage in a fantasy that you know is totally fake, but you're kind of like, let's just watch this stupid movie, you know? I think that.
Did you have any idea? Hold on, did you have any idea when you guys, you know, first broke out in this song and like the play that it was getting? Did you have any idea that it was going to last this long? Because it was at a time when like radio play, like they're just like rolling over song after song after song for the next thing, right? And we're talking what, 20 some 30 years later? What was it, 2000?
Yeah,
it was 23 yeah. years, 23 years now, right?
Yeah, in 2001, did you know it would go viral on TikTok?
There wasn't, but I mean,
everybody hopes.
iTunes yet, man. There was no YouTube. That's, you know, right. we could do a whole podcast on what happened between 2001 and 2005 and really go hard, but
bro, that's literally the positioning line of this show when we say we've been podcasting since before podcasting was even called podcasting.
Listen, kid, I was podcasting. What I'm saying is like, you have, like, I had been in and out of a couple of record deals. I had been in about three serious bands by that time. I had toured with Joan Jett, opening for her on the East Coast in one of my other bands as a lead guitar player. I had seen parts of the music industry. I had been ripped off pretty badly on one project that actually got a record deal that I was cut out of. So I was in a place where I was pretty cynical about the process, and I knew that, yeah, it's a good song, and there's people we don't know in New York like lining up around the block to watch us play it on weekends. But that doesn't mean anything. That could just be, you know, what's happening at this moment. And as soon as you get a record deal, if the product manager doesn't understand it, it's not going to happen. And in the States, that's what happened to us. We didn't. It was out for 6 months in America, and nothing happened. You know, it was on a couple of radio stations. It had come and gone as far as the label was concerned. Right. We went from doing sort of big sheds with Eve Six and Harvey Danger and Zebrahead to playing Lawrence, Kansas in front of two people in November. And, you know, we were we had bronchitis, and we were like sick of the road, and we were really, really tired and broke. And we came home for that Thanksgiving thinking that that was it. We had had our shot, didn't hit. That was the best that I had at that time, and was ready to go get a day job again. And the Sunday after Thanksgiving, my A&R guy called and said, you have to go to Australia on Monday, tomorrow. You have to fly to Australia. And I was like, no, I don't. I have to get in bed and shake this cough. And, you know, like, I'm not going to Australia. And he's like, no, you have to go to Australia because you're going to be number one on the pop charts in Australia. And I didn't believe him. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know that was a thing. I liked AC/DC enough to be curious, but I was like, man, I don't know, dude. Like, we need to stop. We don't have any money. Like, you know, it was bad. It wasn't great news.
Right. Yeah.
But a couple of weeks later, we were in Australia on television, and it was their Christmas number one. And things started to turn around then. But as far as like knowing that anything was ever going to happen like that, there was only cynicism and doubt.
It was just angst.
Yeah, right? there was like a glimmer of like, well, wouldn't that be nice? But it was like, no, your earth science teacher from eighth grade is definitely going to be right about this. You're an idiot. you know.
I feel like there's been, I don't know, roughly a billion covers of Teenage Dirtbag, give or take. But, and I know that for years you talked about the fact that people had been asking you to write a sequel to Teenage Dirtbag, like a part two.
Yeah.
And then I thought it was charming as fuck when Jax beat you to it.
She totally did. And I could never have done that well with an alternate perspective. She really killed it.
What a star she is.
She's kind of a genius. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, I didn't see that one coming at all, because it was completely reversed, and it was like a little grosser than my original, and like, and like more gnarly and more like personal and like more vulnerable. And I thought like, wow, she really, she took whatever was going on with this song and said, no, I'm going like way harder. Yeah. And I thought, yes, approve this interpolation immediately. You idiot. This is fantastic. She's smarter than you. Just roll with it. And yeah, it's I'm really kind of like, I listen to that one here and there. Like, I often listen to our music on Spotify or something just to A-B it, like to see if it's like, and I will listen to a cover or whatever, but hers is the one I tune into the most just to be reminded that it can, like, it's not fixed. It's not in a fixed space. It can do other things. Right. It can be like,
Anyone out there who hasn't heard it, doesn't know what we're referring to, Jax, who is an absolute star on social media, specifically on TikTok. She's actually nominated for Best New Pop Artist, which is insane.
I love it. Go get that. Go get that trophy, Jax.
Fuck, man. Get that shit. Go get that little golden speaker. But yeah, she's been nominated for Best New Pop Artist, which I love. She wrote a part two to Teenage Dirtbag in the voice of Noelle. She's Noelle, and it's brilliant. You can go find it on TikTok. You can find it on YouTube. It is literally everywhere. There's a version of it on YouTube that she sang at the Sirius XM studios. So good. And she's just such a talent. And I thought it was so cool. She posted this video where the two of you were on stage together singing the song, and she looks like a starstruck kid, you know, but this is what she does. She's hanging with A-listers all the time doing music. And what a cool thing for her to like put you on that pedestal like that.
She's so smart. She's way ahead of where I was when I was at her point in my career.
Yeah.
You know, she got me on stage at Madison Square Garden. I mean, that's the holiest of holies, man. I saw AC/DC there when I was 14, and it was the first show I'd ever gone to without my parents. You know, like that was like beyond. And she has command of those spaces in a way that, like, you know, we're a club band. You know, we play clubs and theaters. We enjoy that stuff. We occasionally wind up on a big festival stage and we kind of like try to make the most of it and have a really good time. But what we are really is like a greasy, sweaty club band. That's where we've been for 23 years, is in clubs. So, you know, it's one of these, like, I wonder if they ever found out that this is not what I do all the time. Are they going to pull my card? You know?
Right.
You know, like, imposter syndrome.
Yeah, totally. But that's where she was born. She's like born in the pop, the big arena environment. And she just knows how to do that. And then she goes and relates to one of her fans on TikTok in a way that, like, I've never seen an artist get that personal or have that much exchange. So it's like, you know, she's just she gets it at the very macro, and she gets it at the microscopic. She's a genius.
You mentioned earlier dealing with your A&R rep when he's like, you got to go to Australia. I think back to the days when Tid and I first started broadcasting together in the late 90s, and the A&R guys from the different labels were the bane of my fucking existence. I hated these pricks, and I will tell you, if this is correct, that TikTok and YouTube have killed the A&R reps.
Don't be so sure. I think they're like cockroaches. I mean, first of all, I was just to say this, right? We lucked out so hard. We had the only A&R guy at a major label who collected vinyl in his corner office, never spoke to anybody, and told us we could produce our own record in my mom's basement. Right? He protected us from all the bullshit up until the point we delivered the record. Now the problem is, it's not just your A&R guy who oversees your album. There's the radio people. There's people you never heard of coming up and telling you to wear a pirate shirt and leather pants. There's, like, you know, like, oh, that's the bad ideas come flooding in from everywhere after that. But the creative process with our guy at Columbia was like, it's never happened. Like, that's a one-off. And we're still friends with him. You know, Kevin Patrick is his name. He was a weirdo then. Nobody at the label really was that into him, and they weren't that into us either. So it kind of makes sense. But as far as A&R people, I hate to say this, with few exceptions,
they're fucking cockroaches.
They're just people who wanted to be near music, talked a lot about music, talked a lot of trash about music, and never had the balls to actually go on stage and play in a band. Right? They sought to control it by some other means, you know? So, like, I mean, they're the original, like, I can't do this, but I have a ton of ideas about how it's done. Right? So it's tough dealing with people like that. I and the radio programmer A&R guy relationship is one of the most toxic things in all of American commerce. It is like, I'm surprised there hasn't been fucking civil war with MAGA. No, that's not going to happen. Civil war between radio programmers and fucking A&R guys. That will happen. That I believe in.
Ted, do you remember back in those days when our old internet radio station did a live to air concert? This was a big deal back in 97, 98, because it never happened before, but it was a live to air concert of Moist and Our Lady Peace.
Ooh.
And it was from a venue in Toronto, and we were there backstage because we were supposed to interview the bands after, and then they fucking flaked on us. But anyway, we're there.
Never heard of that happening before.
No, never. Right. And anyway, I remember the lead singer for Our Lady Peace, Rain Maida, he walks in and he's got an A&R guy next to him, who's just this squirmy little beady eyed fuck. And one of the guys that's with us was in a bad mood because we'd been standing around for hours waiting, and he looks at this guy and goes, "Who's the fucking keychain?" And the A&R guy was so, I've never seen a tiny human get so angry. He turned into an instant volcano.
Those guys can be vindictive, man.
God,
right?
I don't know how familiar you are with Canadian rock, but a band that has been around for as long as your first album, really popular up here. Tid and I are going to go see them in Buffalo next week. The Trues, they've been on this program a couple times. A couple weeks ago, guitarist John Angus was on the show, and we've talked to him in the past, and he's talked openly about the challenges of a rock band with your brother. His brother Colin co-founded the Trues with him, and right, they're still doing their thing, and they've had some turnover in their bandmates over the years, over a 20-year span, but those two have been constants. At one point, your brother was in the band.
My brother was the original drummer for the band.
Right.
Yeah.
So what happened there? Do you hate your brother?
No. We I'm not going to say we haven't had a fight, but we played music growing up together, just drums and guitar. And, he got out of college like just around the right time where we would kind of get somebody ready for the drums to play live shows after working on these beats on a drum machine. So he joined up and it was great. And he was my business partner until 2006. And then he wanted to have a family, and we can't do that if you're touring in a van, stuck in the Rocky Mountains. So, he left the band and he just played with us at Mercury Lounge the other night. He jumped on stage for a couple of songs. He and his nephew, his son, Seamus. So yeah, my brother Pete and Seamus, his son, are basically like auxiliary members of the band still. We hang out and do Thanksgiving and Christmas together, and he collects bourbon and we talk about stuff. I mean, like, you know, it's like, it's, our relationship goes beyond the band. There were hard times, but there were never like fractious times, right?
You're not Oasis and you're not the Black Crowes.
Nah. Nah.
We have a few questions that have come in from audience that are listening live. You mind if we throw a couple audience questions at you?
Yeah, sure.
This one is from Ruby in the 212 area code. Where the hell is that?
That's Manhattan. That's Manhattan. Like New York, that's New York City. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It says, "Hi, Brendan. Huge fan of yours since your first album came out. Do you have a song that you wish was as popular as Teenage Dirtbag instead of Teenage Dirtbag?"
Instead of.
And she says for her, it would be Lemonade.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ruby. That's awesome. Hi, neighbor, by the way, from a little bit further uptown. The Lemonade thing is really crazy because that was the song that I wanted to be the first single off our second record, right? Mm. And I delivered it to the label and they were like, "We're never releasing. This is garbage. Forget about this. Go get your day job. You're done." And we walked out of 550 Madison Avenue, the Death Star, with the masters for our second album. We own them. They didn't want them. So now all these years later, Lemonade is one of our most popular streaming songs. Thank you, Ruby. And it's become a thing. It didn't even have a video until it was 8 years old. And it's just become like our second most popular song, so to speak. And we play it at every show and it's tons of fun and everybody knows the words and it's just done its own work. So, and that's really wonderful. But do I have a song that, I think the song that we put out with the Teenage Dirtbag 2020, when we put that out in 2020, mm-hmm. its companion song, because we released like the original album and then the alternate universe first album songs in pairs, like Matter and Antimatter. The song that came out with Teenage Dirtbag is called Mope.
Yes.
And that's one of my favorite ones to play live. I really enjoy that. It's a very old song. It was shelved because it sounded like album one through the years, you know. But it's got a guitar solo in it. You know, not all of our songs have that. And a wah-wah guitar solo, too. So I'm like, you know, totally posing. And
I love that.
Yeah. And I really dig that song. It's got a kind of wicked bass line that has a lot of voice to it and walks around and speaks a lot. So I think Mope would probably be not instead of Teenage Dirtbag, but I'd be just as happy. You know, I'd be like, okay, cool. You know,
yeah.
Cool with that.
There's another one here that came in from the 317. It says,
I don't know that one.
I don't either. It says, BBB, I'm a musician who's getting ready to release his first album. I'm trying to understand something. If your music gets played on Spotify or Amazon, you get a royalty. What about all the plays when your song goes viral on TikTok? Are you making money off that?
Yes. So, but you have to have your metadata in place. I'm assuming that you're distributing to TikTok through one of the distribution aggregators like TuneCore or The Orchard, which is, I think, called DistroKid. And as long as you have put all the relevant information up there, there should be some collecting happening. Now, there are a couple of sides to royalties. There's the master sync royalty, which is just the physical copy of, well, digital copy of what you've made, the one recording being played over and over again. And then there's the intellectual property, which is covered when somebody does a cover of your song or like somebody uses a version of it for a commercial that's not your original or something like that, or interpolates like Jax did. You know, I share publishing with Jax on that song because she wrote a totally different thing. So, or not totally, but it's called an interpolation. So you should definitely look at how you're distributing, go into the fine print of your distribution outlet, whatever you're using. If you're not using one, I highly recommend it. I'm not sure how you would be going about this if you weren't, but there's lots of things I don't know because I'm 49. So go ahead and take a look at the fine print of your distributor, your online distributor, and figure out how they collect royalties. A lot of them offer programs for artists that don't have publishing deals, like old school artists like me. Some of us have publishing deals. Some even have like long-term record deals that are still in place. And there's like a multinational company somewhere trying to get your royalties for you or share it with you. So you should look at that and figure out how those, whatever your distributor is, how they handle that side of it. Some of them offer like label services kind of deals where they take a little bit more money from you on your royalties, but they go and they collect stuff from overseas and places that you maybe are not
stuff you'd never think to go look
right.
for.
Exactly.
Like I love that you didn't gloss over this answer. You gave the guy a real functional answer.
This is important stuff. I just anything I wish somebody told me when I was younger.
I love that.
I'm going.
Now what if somebody happens to use your song for years and years and years as their entrance music because they're a professional wrestler?
Spider?
listen.
And I love Spider. Don't get me wrong. I love Spider.
These are all business decisions, right? You got to be careful with this stuff because let's be honest. There's a lot of people in the indie wrestling community who are, without a doubt, the most loyal fans in the world, right?
Yeah, we know
there's
firsthand.
There's nobody more quirky. There's nobody more awesome. There's nobody more welcoming than the indie like wrestling community. There's nothing that is that open-minded and that sort of weird and awesome. To have those people on our side, worth it. for 20 something odd years, Nate getting away with it. Sure, man. And right. You know, Nate's my friend. So it's like, it's this guy literally went into the ring to fight for that song to be played in its entirety every time he walks out. Right. So I'm not going to ask a guy like that for money. That's nuts. That's crazy.
So who came to who for the cooking show song then?
He can. we talk sometimes on the phone late at night. We're like phone buddies, and he's like, he'll call me at like 12 midnight, and I'll be like, "What are you doing, man?" He's like, "Nothing, just making, you know, just making a souffle." You know? I'd be like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "I got some really high quality beef. I'm gonna do some like, you know, some Kobe burgers and a souffle, you know." Garnish it with some asparagus. I'm like, dude, did you just crank up the oven now, or is this like tomorrow? And he's like, no, I'm fucking, I'm doing it now. You know, I'll be done maybe around 5 a.m. He's like, well, I was like, well, you know, what are you doing, man? Are you serious? You're like fucking cook in the middle of the night. He's like, yeah, it soothes me, man. I'm like, I like to chill out, make a sick meal, you know, eat it at like 7 a.m. and then go to bed. You know, it's great. And I'm like, you know what? You like, when he got his cooking show, I was like, can I please do your theme song? Like, just let's do this. You know, I like, tell me over the phone right now what you want me to sing. And he's like, mashed potatoes, oh no, gravy, blah, blah, blah. You know what I'm saying? Like, he just started saying it, right? Like, he got like, kind of got excited. Like, he's about to go into the ring. Like, he's talking shit to the camera or something, or like to the heel, you know? And I'm like, right, it, like, yeah. So say that again. What'd you say? You know? So that was the lyrics. It's just him shouting down the phone at me at 2 o'clock in the morning about making the souffle or something, you know?
So two takeaways from that, Tid, if 25 years ago, when you started as a professional wrestler, if you had been using Wheatus's music by now, you guys would have been pals. And then I could have been calling Brendan at 2 a.m. when I'm cooking.
Or we would have just ended up doing some match, me and Nate. Over who's going to get to use the song without royalty fees.
Well, for you're the twice next 20 his size, so I don't like Nate's odds.
He's wiry.
He's
wiry.
He is, wiry. Man. He's. I've seen him do. I saw him with Homicide in a match one time.
Yeah.
They. There was some improv going on in that match that I couldn't watch. I was like, oh man, I can't see it. You know, like. He's, you know, Nate's kind of almost my, like, we're in the same age bracket. He's a little younger than I am, but I know what can happen if that goes wrong.
You're actually a fan of the business, eh?
I am. I have an enormous amount of respect for the physicality and the work that goes into that shit. It is bananas. You're basically dealing with like full on hyper dangerous professional stunt maneuvers done by acrobats, you know, watching Marco stunt do his like, are you kidding me, man? That shit is dangerous. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, I'm not just gonna roll up on this profession and think I have a place in it. Like, this demands respect. And I was fortunate enough to be briefly trained by Ashley Massaro back on Long Island. She was a rest in peace. She lived two towns over from me when I was growing up. We never bumped into each other, never knew each other at all. But we met through a DJ on Long Island, this guy, Orlando. And, you know, she found out that I was going into this match, and I was nervous. I was just like, man, this is bad. Like, don't come into these people's profession and just like a Holly go lightly and just kind of traipse around the ring and be like, oh, my song, you know, like, that's not cool. Figure out how to do this. And I asked if she would train me. And so they took me out to like the shores of Lake Ronkonkoma. And she told me the right way to do, you know, a DDT and a couple of other moves. And, you know, it occurred to me, like, these people beat the crap out of each other. Like, their bodies. I've been backstage a couple of times and seen guys get hurt and seen dudes who've been showing up for 50 years to wrestle. And they're like literally putting their knees back together to get out there. I mean, that is like, that's more than I do. You know,
we just talked at the top of the show how Tid just had his last match in December and his spine's all fucked up. So, you know, this is a guy who broke his neck in the ring.
Yeah.
You know, going off the top rope. When people say,
and I stayed out for 6 months.
Yeah. Jeez. After breaking his neck, like, idiot.
Man.
But people go, oh, it's so fake. I'm like, it's not fake. It's
predetermined. You ever see that John Stossel getting smacked out when who smacked? Is this feel fake?
Yeah.
Oh, that's David Schultz.
Yeah.
Well, you talked about homicide. I mean, a guy who was close with for years, Steve Carino. He hated homicide with a passion for years because homicide smacked Carino so hard in the ear. He has no hearing in that ear to this day.
I mean, that sucks, but that's that's kind of what these people sign up for. This is hard work, man. Like I don't do it. I saw what went into the matches and what goes into the training. And, you know, if you're a joker and you think that's easy, come try and figure it out.
But less the physicality of it. There's a lot of similarities, you know what I mean? Between like that rock and roll lifestyle and professional wrestling, you know, the physicality. I mean, it's long hours on the road. It's trying to get to these little places. You don't know how many people are going to be there the next day, but you have to go out there and perform you're on cloud nine and it's Madison Square Garden and it's the main event and you still have a job to do every single time. So like, and I think that's a glamour. That's a glamour that I think a lot of people have before getting into either one of the businesses, really. You know what I mean? And then when you get out there, you're like, this is, do I really fucking love this?
that's exactly similar. The glory moment is this big, you know, and the rest of what lies underneath the surface of the water is this iceberg of dog shit that you got to figure out all the time, you know? Yeah. And like you'd go ahead and do any passion for a living, right? If you're lucky enough to get there, I guarantee you it will test your feelings about how passionate you can be, right? It will test you. It will be, you'll be like, you'll have days where you're like, I can't believe I'm about to do this again. like it's just a thing. But then you're right. There's nothing like the Lost in New York show, the first one I wrestled at, when those matches popped off and that crowd was lighting up, the only thing I can relate it to is like Angus Young walking out on stage at the beginning of an AC/DC. Right. Like it was like that kind of energy, that raw, like primal, like here we go, you know, like, and you can't pay for that. You can't buy that. Yeah. That's talent and preparation and hard work. And like you said, just like you got to light it up. Like it's MSG on the best night ever, no matter if it's two people in the audience or whatever, you got to do that. So,
respect. Dude, as a longtime fan of the band, I've been jonesing ever since I first heard this project announced a few years ago. Where is You Might Die? Where is the weirdest movie, the weirdest documentary? Because I've heard rumors that you're a bit of a tyrant on this thing, and I just got to watch it.
I can't claim to have always been an easy person to work for or to work with. That is definitely true. I've never ripped anybody off. And I tried to make it in the end that people were happy that they showed up, whether it's employees or people we work with on the road. But I got to tell you, there were some years in the dark days when maybe we really shouldn't have been on the road. It was too much stress. Like I was tour managing. We were $120,000 in debt, dealing with jokers who were promoting shows very poorly. And you know, a lot of that's in the film because the guys joined us during the darkest years. They signed on to make a movie during the worst of the worst of the worst. And, you know, obviously financial stress is super real. I definitely could have done a much better job, and I'll leave that to you guys to judge when you see it. But I left it out there, warts and all, kind of. And we're just kind of trying to tidy it up because the story keeps changing a lot. Like the problem what we've had is that so much has happened over the last 3 years with us
that
the movie makes sense for its time, but we have to try and figure out how to finish it, you know, because it's like there's this other part of the story and we're not going to make a sequel.
You just stop and then you do a sequel, or you let Jack do the sequel.
And also what you do is you don't lose the fucking Masters this time around for this documentary.
Well, luckily there's a really responsible guy named Ian in charge of that and not myself or a major multinational record company that will not be named.
We have multiple text messages coming in, a whole bunch of them saying, Donnie, Tid, can you please, please, please ask Brendan if he could play Teenage Dirtbag for us acoustic?
Yes, I will do that. Yeah. I'm not sure. Miking wise, I'll do my best. So let me see what I can do here. Hang on.
We're in the virtual world, baby. We know it's not going to be mastered the way that we would love.
Yeah. We're not going to use all the equipment surrounding me. We're just going to go simple.
What are we choosing to play on? Because I know that you are a fan of a big guitar.
I like a big guitar as well. Right? I like a big old acoustic guitar. I love mariachi bands. I love the way that they look when there's this big ass guitar. Looks like you have a Chevy wrapped around your neck, you know. I really dig on that. And so this is a custom acoustic that somebody made me. Somebody in New Jersey
who doesn't make it. I've noticed it watching you play some of your studio stuff that you've been putting out, like with your covers and that. I was like, that is a beaut.
Yeah, it's 19 inches from bout to bout here. And it's got 36 frets. The challenge was, as always with us, to try and make a hybrid of something that doesn't exist yet. So I wanted a full on, like, lots of frets metal shredder, but that was built like a jazz guitar, like a big old jazz arch top, you know. Jazz
that sounds box. Very apropos for the way that you go about making music.
Yeah.
It has to be everything.
It has to be a perfect combination of everything.
But does it go up to 11?
I'll tell you what, man, it goes up to 36. Okay,
there we go. Woo!
Right. All right, let's see how this sounds.
All right.
Her name is Noelle. And I have a dream about her. She rings my bell. I got you in class in half an hour. Oh, how she rocks in a kid's and tube socks. But she doesn't know who I am. And she doesn't give a damn about me. Cause I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Yeah, I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Listen to Iron Maiden, baby, with me. Ooh. Her boyfriend's a dick. And he brings a gun to school and he'd simply kick my ass if he knew the truth. He lives on my block and he drives an IROC. But he doesn't know who I am. And he doesn't give a damn about me. Cause I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Yeah, I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Listen to Iron Maiden, baby, with me. Ooh. Oh, yeah, dirtbag. No, she doesn't know what she's missing. She's missing. Man, I feel like mold. It's prom night and I am lonely. Lo and behold, she's walking over to me. This must be fate. My lips start to shake. And how does she know who I am? And why does she give a damn about me? She said, I got tickets to Iron Maiden, baby. Come with me Friday, don't say maybe.
I'm just a teenage dirtbag baby like you. Ooh. She's missing. Oh yeah, dirtbag. No, she doesn't know what she's missing. Oh, oh, oh.
It sound okay with the mic here, dude, and the whole.
I got the biggest, stupidest smile on my face that whole time. I'm sitting here rocking out. Thank you awesome. So much for doing that Sweet. For us, man.
Yeah, man.
That's anytime. A highlight. If this is our last episode ever, I'm good.
Well, I hope not. But thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. You know, it's weird and cool to be a band that's as old and weird as we are and still have people care. So I appreciate it, you know.
Totally care, dude. And you know what? Before you go, I'm just going to say, I know that you're playing a festival, the Adjacent Festival in Atlantic City, Memorial Day weekend.
That's right.
I love Atlantic City. Tid, we might have to do a road trip, my brother.
I'm in. Let's go. Let's do you some know gambling.
What? That I don't gamble, but I'll watch you guys gamble. Definitely.
Let's do it. That's a date.
I okay. love that.
The whole weekend. So where are you guys located? You're in Canada?
Toronto.
Yeah, okay.
But I'm an American originally.
Yeah.
I'm from a little town. I'm from a little gambling town called Las Vegas.
Oh, hey.
But they kicked him out.
I've heard of it.
Yeah. No, but that's a whole other that's a whole other podcast in itself too. Dude, trust me there.
You know, I mean, there's like, that's a special town. If you like, you don't meet a lot of people who grew up in Vegas. Like That's different, man. That's different. No.
Yeah, we're some real dirtbags.
I'd like to hear those stories. That's some desert.
Well, you know what? When we come down for Memorial Day, we'll go out and you'll get to hear some of those stories.
All right. All right. I'm in. Count me in.
They're good stories. All right. Brendan, tell everyone out there if they want to get more information about Wheatus, about the new album.
Yeah, sure. So
about everything.
Wheatus.com. Wheatus.com/shows. Wheatus.com for merch. You know, I'm on Twitter myself personally, telling Elon Musk he's an asshole. You know, you got like every other asshole. We got Instagram and TikTok are run by Joey and Matthew and myself sometimes. We don't have a manager. We don't have a record label. So if you're interacting with one of our accounts, it's actually us. And, you know, we just like being an independent band and you know, connecting with people who care, and we'll keep doing that. Like you said, the movie You Might Die is on the horizon for 2023. No one's ever going to want to talk to me again after that, but that's fine. You know,
we will.
The truth.
We want to have a screening party.
Yeah, there's a lot of trauma and rejuvenation in it. Let's just call it that. So,
and then it was like story, man.
Yeah, it's sort of it was I like it because it's a pre comeback story.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Where's that hyphenated, Brandon? Where's that hyphenated?
As it was coming out of my mouth, guy. As it was coming, you know what? I just stopped.
Pre comeback story is a better title.
That's a good album right there. Pre comeback story.
Forget You Might Die. Call it the comeback story.
On right now. What happened? This was going so well. We were talking about where to get music and good wholesome story about a band that tried and finally did something. And here we are. We're here now. It.
Brendan, thanks for hanging out with us and being so generous with your time, man. We'll hopefully do this again sometime.
Thank you, guys. Love you both. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
There he goes, everybody. That is Brendan, the lead man from Wheatus. I absolutely love that. What a fun guy. What a great opportunity that was for us. Tid, we are way long on time. Any parting shots before we say goodnight?
No, thank you to all of you that stayed with us through this entire thing. We've got some big announcements coming up.
Yeah, in the next little while. Big show news.
Some stuff that we're going to be doing. We're not ready to announce it yet, but it's going to be a lot more of us for all of you. So we're sorry and we're happy about it. We're sorry to you for having to put up with this, but we're happy about it. So thank you and good night.
Congratulations to the person in the 519 area code who guessed correct. 13 Weedus songs in my introduction tonight. 13 Weedus songs. I'm going to send you one of our brand new t-shirts with the new logo that just came out last week. We're going to send that out next week.
Tremendous.
Thank you so much for joining us. We are the Godfathers of Podcasting and we'll see you next time.
Fuck this shit, I'm out. Mm-mm. Fuck this shit, I'm out.
No thanks.
Don't mind me, I'ma just grab my stuff and leave. Excuse me, please. Fuck this shit, I'm out.
Nope.
Fuck this shit, I'm out.
Alright then.
I don't know what the fuck just happened, but I don't really care. I'ma get the fuck up out of
here. Fuck this shit, I'm out.